you. And I don't see any reason why you shouldn't go from very simple to more and more complex to more and more complex.
I don't either. I don't either. But I don't know how you get from mud to a living cell. That's my question.
Yes, well, I've told you.
I think it's on the
back of crystals. Try one more time.
On the backs of crystals.
On the backs of crystals is at least one hypothesis, yes.
So that's your theory, and you think that is more likely and less far-fetched than intelligent design?
I think it is.
Well, now you know. This is the best explanation that they've got. Comparing it to crystals, which themselves don't reproduce, but somehow you're going to get on the back of the crystal and get the cell that we're talking about. Look at the illustration of this kind of prejudiced thinking. Here's the scientist. He looks at a rock chip and he sees, yeah, there's a chip out of the side of this. Somebody's been working it. And so it's shaped. This is a prehistoric tool. There's intelligent design. He can discern that from what he's looking at. He might be right. But then the same fella looks at the yeast cell, and there you see 42 million machines organized and functioning together with 1 million rotations per second, and you don't see any intelligent design. Does that make sense to you? You see a chip in the side of a rock, yep, that's intelligent design. If you see organization of 42 million proteins, 210 trillion molecules functioning together, rotating in 1 million rotations per second, no intelligent. Now, that takes a lot of blind prejudice in order to see one and not the other. But that's what we see in science today. I think it's disgusting. When you look at the evidence in the world around us of design, we see the proverbial arrowheads, the hearts with John Love Mary, all the way through the world. You see the yeast cell. You see the fly with ants on his wing. You see the origami of the hummingbird, the outboard motor on the back of the bacteria. Design all the way through. Well, how do you account for that? Trees that equal the hydroelectric power that we see throughout the world. Maybe you can explain that by a molecule on the back of a crystal. But I don't think that works. I don't believe that has the explanatory power of the design that we see throughout the universe. Are you getting an idea of what creation science is? It ain't about Genesis 1 through 3. That's a good place to look and great evidence, but that's not what creation science is. It involves dealing with the evidence that Richard Dawkins, sometimes referred to as the Pope of Evolution, says, yeah, and this is in the forward to his book, Blind Watchmaker, and from the title, you understand where he's coming from. You look at the world today, you can define biology as the appearance of things having been designed. That's what it looks like. And of course, I respond, well, maybe it's what it looks like. That's the way science is supposed to work. No, you have to understand it didn't happen that way, though it looks that way, he said. Francis Crick, describer of DNA, Nobel laureate, says biologists must constantly keep in mind that what we're seeing wasn't designed. It looks that way, but you got to remind yourself, no, it's not that way. He's got to keep his blinders on, is what he's saying, another way to say it. You're in the classroom and they begin to talk about the bacterial flagellum, and you see design all over the place, and no, you can't have that. That's not allowed. Or someone said no intelligence allowed now. Certainly in our explanation of what we see in the living world. Both evolution and creation can be investigated scientifically. And I think when you compare the two, you can see which one works better. Molecule on the back of crystals. No, it takes more than that. It takes a designer. When you see design in the things that we've looked at here this evening and compare their explanation, if you didn't have the intimidation and the slander and the misrepresentation, I think the battle would be over in a very short time. Unfortunately, it's not over. Both viewpoints do have profound religious implications, and because creation has a religious implication, therefore it can't be in the classroom. Well, that's a very naive way to view it, because evolution has profound religious implications just as well. Both of them do. Let me give you an example of that. Again, looking at a clip here from Richard Dawkins, which we hope to be able to.
So was there a defining moment where you made a decision that you didn't believe in God? Or?
Yes, I suppose I switched from Christian theism to some sort of deism round about the age of 14 or 15, and then switched to atheism round about the age of 16.
And was there a particular point that, or something that you read or an experience you had that sort of said, yeah, this is it, God doesn't exist?
Oh, well, by far the most important, I suppose, was understanding evolution. I think the evangelical Christians have really sort of got it right in a way in seeing evolution as the enemy, whereas the more, what should we say, sophisticated theologians who are quite happy to live with evolution, I think they're deluded, and I think the evangelicals have got it right in that there really is a deep incompatibility between evolution and Christianity, and I think I realized that at the age of about 16.
Now, to deny that there are religious implications is rather foolish. Notice the statement of a very famous naturalist, Harold Urey, who was famous for his experiment which is used to support origin of life, which doesn't, but that's a different subject. Professor of chemistry at Columbia and at University of Oxford, Institute for Nuclear Studies, University of Chicago, editor of the Journal of Chemical Physics, Nobel Prize in Chemistry. Pretty good credentials, I would think. He says, all of us who study the origin of life find that the more we look into it, the more we feel it's too complex to have evolved anywhere. Well, you look at the yeast cell, and it's foolish to reach any other conclusion, but it's obvious to him. However, he doesn't buy that. That's what he sees, and he admits it. We believe, as an article of faith, that life evolved from dead matter on this planet. In spite of the fact, you look at it and you can't see how, but you know, as a matter, and the faith he's talking about is not like our faith that we can defend. It's just in spite of the evidence, certainly not because of it. Now, that's illustrative of the thinking that we see in the world. And to say they have no religious implications is extremely naive. The unbeliever believes nothing produced everything. That there was nothing, and nothing happened to nothing until nothing magically exploded for no reason at all, and then created everything. And then a bunch of everything magically rearranged itself for no reason into self-replicating parts, which turned into dinosaurs and eventually into people. And that's what they believe. Now, that takes a lot of faith. Big explosion produced the ordered universe. Molecules self-assembled become living cells. Chaos produces information. Errors in information produce more information. Non-reason produces reason. That's their religion. That's what they just scrunch up their eyes and, in spite of the evidence, believe. They've chosen not to be a Catholic or a Baptist, but to be an evolutionist, to be a naturalist. And because of that faith, blind faith, they ignore the evidence. And it has tremendous implications. Does it make a difference? Well, consider the book Evolutionary Ethics, which seems like a contradiction in terms, but it produces a very perverted form of ethics. Notice the thinking as expressed by Jeremy Rydkin, who, by the way, is the author of the Green New Deal that you may have heard of. He said, and this is the kind of thinking that comes from his atheistic viewpoint. We no longer consider ourselves to be guests in someone else's home, and therefore obligated to make our behavior conform with the pre-existing cosmic rules. It is our creation now, and we make the rules. We no longer have to justify our behavior, for we are now architects of the universe. We are responsible to nothing outside ourselves, for we are the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever and ever. That's evolutionary ethics. But it's not religious. It has no religious implications, which is nuts. More of that hogwash we were talking about. Let's think about the religious implications, that is, the legal implications. Because some will say, well, it doesn't really matter because the law says you can't do anything. And they want you to think that. But our public school system is not absolutely invulnerable. Many authorities are saying, yes, there is a way, and they are doing it. And Texas, by the way, is leading the way. But a number of states have implemented such policies. Beginning and leading the way is Texas. Other states have followed. That students must, and this is from the Texas resolution, compare and contrast scientific explanations for cellular complexity. Examine scientific explanations for the origin of DNA and abrupt appearance and stasis, that's staying the same, in the fossil record. We'll talk more about that Wednesday evening. This is now law in Texas, and other states we're making progress, but a lot of people are still intimidated and think that they have no choice. In spite of all the propaganda, there's some pretty good indications. From Gallup poll here, we find 40% believe that God created humans in their present form. We'd like to see it higher than that. But that's better than the 33% that believe in God-guided evolution or theistic evolution, and the 22% that believe what's preached in the classroom in most places, that it's naturalistic evolution. We'd like to see it better, but we're still winning, at least from one perspective, when we test ideas that seem like common sense denied by the courts, we are encouraged. Here is a proposition that was tested nationwide in 16. Teachers and students should have the academic freedom to discuss both strengths and weaknesses of the theory of evolution. 93% across the nation agreed with that. It's important for policymakers to stand to hear from students, scientists, I'm sorry, with different views. 94% say, yes, you ought to hear from those with, this would make sense, and that's what we think, but that's not being followed in the courts often, unfortunately. There are at least 5 Nobel laureates now who have endorsed intelligent design. We're told nobody that knows anything would endorse intelligent design, and it's just, they're just not telling the truth. When you think that science and religion is totally incompatible, which is what they would like to sell, there's a lot of evidence to the contrary. One interesting fact I ran across recently involved the Jews, not necessarily religious, but most of them would be. We're talking about 2%. No, not 2%. We're talking about 2/10 of 1% of the world's population. And we're using them because this is a group we can break out and sort of compare. Regarding Nobel Prizes, they have 20% of the Nobel Prizes in chemistry, 20%, no, 26% in physics, 27% in medicine, 0.2% of the world's population, much less than one, but a large percentage of the Nobel Prizes. But science and religion is incompatible. You think? Looks like it's helping out. It would be hard to find a similar percentage that would compare. Ernst Mayr, though, looks at science and says he's one of the leading evolutionists there from Harvard, biologist. No educated person any longer questions the validity of the so-called theory of evolution. This is what's preached in the classroom. And students are intimidated. And it's just not so. And I know he knows it's not so, but you still hear that preached. And it's obviously untrue. It's a fact. Here is Richard Dawkins, who tells you how to deal with that. You see the evolutionist winning, and now even Nobel laureates are jumping on board. Well, you go beyond humorous ridicule. He's the leader of the evolutionist, the Pope, according to some of them. Sharpen our barbs, points where they really hurt. I think they're likely to be swayed by a display of naked contempt. Nobody wants to be laughed at. Nobody. Here is the tactic that is just disgusting. Contempt. The butt of the jokes. And this is the way they maintain their position in science. We look at Darwin, who said, the fair result can be obtained only by stating and balancing facts and arguments on both sides of each question. I don't like to find myself on the same side with Darwin, but I think he's right, and he's very different from those who are losing the battle and fighting back unfairly. And if you had time, I could give you some disgusting examples, including me with some of their efforts. Let's define our terms, and this is looking at both sides. Let's consider what's being said and some of the arguments that are being made before we conclude. The term macroevolution and micro describes little bitty changes and big changes, but we're talking about horizontal variation within the kind that we see in the world around us, which is often pointed to as evidence of evolution. You see variations, and from a common kind, you can produce most of these within 25 to 30 years. That's not the issue. We see horizontal variation. The issue is a common origin producing different kinds. That's the macro evolution. And that is the issue, and that's what cannot be demonstrated, the change from one kind to another kind. And if you make the distinction between those two factors, those two viewpoints, you eliminate about 80% of the argumentation. And I can illustrate that. But the horizontal variation within the kind is different from the change from one kind to another kind. And do not be confused or misled by that. The way to appropriately proceed in a scientific discussion that would be creation science, is described in science as model comparison. You look at the evidence from various fields of science in biology and microbiology and physics and geology, anthropology, as it would relate to creation, as it would relate to evolution, which one explains the facts best. And that's the way. I mean, you don't observe either one happening, and so you can't reproduce evolution in the classroom. Ape to man, you can't put that in a test tube or redo it, but you proceed with model comparison, which is basically saying which one explains the data best, sometimes referred to as Occam's razor or principle of parsimony, terms that biologists may be familiar with. Here are the facts, which one works better? That's just fundamental science. And using that methodology, let's look at what Darwin saw and see which works better. And we've lost a picture here, and I'm not sure how or why, but I'm probably going to need some help. Something disappeared. Can we see what happened here? May have punched the wrong button. What's that? Okay, it's not back for me. We're used to working with my computer up here, and we're gonna have to be taught a new methodology, I guess. You are holding my time, right? Okay. AV folks are my heroes. Thank you. Wow, it's still not perfect. But anyway, let's look at what Darwin saw. He made a trip around the world as a ship's naturalist on the Beagle and saw some animals he hadn't seen before, pretty strange critters that didn't grow in England. And he's trying to decide, how did this come about? Where did they come from? And he's going to do it without God, because God killed his daughter. God's book says his father would go to hell, and so he hates God, and that's pretty obvious from his letters and his books. Now, he saw finches, and we get a lot of information about the evolution of the finches. That's in all the biology textbooks. And what we're looking at are finches with big beaks and finches with little beaks. There's some variation, but you see that. Now, the Bible describes hawks as one kind. That's a super family in biology. It includes a lot of variation that I think is designed, beautiful designs. But here, we don't see change happening, but we see the result of variation, it would appear. Some with big beaks, some with little beaks, and you see them selected with on the islands. There were a series of islands there, the Galapagos Islands, where you got no trees. And they were making a living eating the seeds, and they need the big beaks to do that. And the ones that had the big beaks survived well on those islands. But with trees where there were insects, they could use the sharp, pointy beaks to reach in the bark. They could make a living there. And so the ones with the sharp, pointy beaks wound up together with the trees. Nothing apparently changed, or it wasn't seen, but that's what we're looking at. That's certainly not changing to an eagle or to anything significantly different. This is what we would call macroevolution. I believe it's horizontal, and we can see that. Macroevolution was not seen, but notice the description of an updated version of this story that's told in all of the biology textbooks from 206, and actually there have been some articles since then. Here is Darwin's finches evolved before scientists' eyes. Okay, that's the kind of evidence we'd be looking for if we're able to see that. not to get this to run like it's supposed to. He says, we have observed evolutionary changes driven by competition for resources. Okay, this is what we're looking for. What do we actually see? The rest of the story shows that they're talking about the shrinkage of beaks during a drought. And they saw the shrinkage, they said, though that shrinkage didn't happen, it was selected. The relative numbers of beaks, the two sizes were there to start with, but you got more of the smaller during the drought and less of the bigger. And so that's what they're talking about, a change in the relative numbers. Nothing new at all, only the relative numbers, which they acknowledge, and you can see when you read the article. Then we find that speciation is undone. It's going backwards now. And while you don't see this in the textbooks, you'll see 14 species that he identified. Now then, it's down to two as a result of other droughts and changes in the environment. It is reversible, which is a picture compatible with horizontal variation, which was our definition of it. It goes this way, and it goes that way, and it goes back. It's not accumulating and producing anything significantly different. They're not eagles or anything different. But you still see the propaganda continuing. This is 2018, the bird's evolutionary biologist's most celebrated example of natural selection. All you got is a change in relative numbers of beak sizes. And that's the most celebrated example they got. They may be right. But I don't think that's significant as far as our issue is concerned. We need to look at what Darwin did not see. He didn't see a bird dog, did he? Or a cowbird, or some of the things that we laugh at and we think, nah, that's silly. You can't see anything like that. We see beaks that get a little bigger. No, they don't get bigger, but you select the ones that are bigger or smaller. Well, that's not going to help. And what would help, you don't see. And when you see it pictured, you laugh. That's not happening. What you see, what Darwin saw, was an example of horizontal variation. It goes this way, and then it goes that way, and then it comes back, and it's not changing from one thing to another. Horizontal variation within the kind that we observe is not an issue. Then in our textbooks, we see the example of the pepper moths. These two examples are the primary examples in all of the biology textbooks. Before the Industrial Revolution, when the tree trunks were gray, then the black moths stood out. And the theory is they got it. The camouflaged lighter color ones were hidden. They didn't. After the Industrial Revolution, then the situation reversed and the black ones were camouflaged. And we do appear to see some change in relative numbers. That's the way it's quoted, though there's some reasons to question that, as we'll see. But that's the example. Now, I think we have a good summary of that evidence by Matthews in the centennial edition of Origin of the Species. 100 years since Origin of the Species, a new edition, and he has the honor of writing the most famous biologist in England, and he's chosen to write the introduction. And we can get this to go the right way. I'll show you what he said. He says, in that original centennial edition, the peppered moth, Mr. Bachelera, experiments do not show evolution in progress. or however the population might alter, all of the moths remain from beginning to end, Bischof and Bechelera. They had light and dark ones to start with. They had light ones and dark ones to end with. The relative numbers shifted, but that's not evolution. And their most famous biologist said, nope, your primary example is not evolution at all. But we still see here in the International Wildlife Encyclopedia the most striking evolutionary change ever witnessed by man. I think they're right. That's it. And it's not impressive. You see the propaganda continuing. Jerry Cohn, who is one of the most vicious anti-creationists in the country, acknowledged this in Nature as he's analyzing Kidwell's experiments, who reproduced some of what Darwin saw. He said the most serious problem is that Bischof and Bechelera probably doesn't rest on tree trunks. Well, I've seen thousands of them on tree trunks in the textbooks. And how did they get there? They got pinned there for the photograph, and he points that out. And he's not on our side at all. Exactly two moths have been seen in such a position in more than 40 years. Well, now that's a problem, because that's the way they represent it as the argument. Here in Science, 2011, front page, peppered moth Bischof and Bechelera is one of the most widely recognized examples of contemporary evolutionary change. The best they got. And they're still preaching it. Here it is on the front page of American Biology Teacher, 2018. This is not old news. This is what they're continuing, and that's it. I think they ought to be embarrassed. What we do see is a shift in the relative numbers of pre-existing horizontal variations. I think that's an objective, fair, accurate description of what we see. And when you say it accurately, objectively, they're without evidence. Darwin observed variations. He saw small changes and assumed that those small changes would add up to the big changes. Now, that assumption, I think, has been tested and has been falsified. We look, for example, well, you can't test it because it takes millions of years, is the standard objection. But you look at fruit flies, which reproduce up to once every 2 weeks, new generation, and they've been doing that for decades in the classrooms, doing terrible things to these fruit flies, pulling their wings off and radiating them and exposing them to mutagenic chemicals. And they got the highest mutation rate of almost any other critter. And so you get something with a high mutation rate and you do all these terrible things. You ought to get some changes in thousands of generations. Bacteria can reproduce up to once every 20 minutes. You get billions under laboratory conditions. But you don't see a change in the basic kind. Michael DeSaul is talking in the Encyclopedia of Life Sciences about Drosophila, the fruit fly. If mutation were a variation of value, then the evolution of Drosophila should have proceeded with extreme rapidity. It really mutates. The facts entirely contradict the validity of this theoretical deduction, for we have seen that Drosophila type has not been modified in any way. And he's talking back in the fossil record. It's still the same critter. Some of them got purple eyes, and some of them go run around without wings, but it's the same critter. In terms of bacteria, reproducing once every 20 minutes sometimes, your bacteria population do not progress. This is Warner Braun, who's one of the leading authorities in bacterial genetics. Do not progress beyond boundaries. They go this far and they stop. Here's a report of bacteria from the fossil record. They look the same as the bacteria of the same region from 2.3 billion years ago, which I don't buy, but let's play the game their way and see how it comes out. The bacteria reproducing up to once every 20 minutes for a billion years. Same thing. Hasn't changed. They are indistinguishable from our modern bacteria. You look in the inclusions of amber. We've got some of it back there in the displays. Here is a report from National Geographic, certainly not the friend of the creationist, reporting on a find of 356 animal inclusions from over 200 million years ago. Surprisingly, these microscopic organisms look familiar to today's scientists, undergoing few or no physical changes. You look at the scorpion and you look at the mosquito back in the amber. It looks just like the ones you see today, supposed to be 100 million years old. When you look at the finches that get bigger and smaller beaks, you get the bacteria that don't progress beyond boundaries, the fruit flies that have not progressed, and the inclusions that are indistinguishable. You test the assumption that the little ones add up to the big ones. No, you can't. But you can when you have organisms that reproduce very rapidly, and you can observe billions, in some cases, of generations, and you see that is tested. What you have is two observations. You have variation, horizontal variation, and you have boundaries to it. Both observations are there. Variations, boundaries. They talk about one, they ignore the other. Eugene Koonin may be the most representative microbiologist in America today. Here he is with the National Center for Biotechnology Information, reporting on the progress in evolutionary theory, in trends in genetics. He says the traditional concepts in the Tree of Life, which was right in the front of Darwin's book, this tree that everybody said, he said that's gone. That does not work. The natural selection, the main driving force of evolution, he says, that's gone. That doesn't work anymore. Now, here's the leading authority. He says the modern synthesis, synthesizing Mendelian genetics with Darwinian natural selection, the modern theory of evolution, has crumbled, apparently beyond repair. Not to mince words, the modern synthesis is gone. You won't find that in your textbook, but this is what the leading authorities in the field are saying today. It's gone. In fact, here in 2021, in the editorial in Science, survival of the fittest does not accurately represent the dynamics of evolutionary progress. Did you know that? That's reported in the leading science journal in the United States, in the editorial. You need to tell your biology teacher about that. That will surprise them. Creation science involves looking at the evidence, not just one side, but looking at all of the evidence. And when you do, I think there's no contest, but you think and evaluate which model works best. You look at the evidence from the things that we've looked at, and I think it explains the implication of intelligence, and that implication is not explained by the evolutionist. Which model explains the data best? Now, remember what we're talking about tonight. If you're convinced by the evidence, yeah, this side works better, good. I'm happy with that, but that's not what we're talking about tonight. What we're talking about tonight is a definition of creation science. What is it? Quoting from the King James Bible, holy religious dogma. Is that what you heard tonight? you got indoctrinated in what it is. You know, in spite of the lies, you know what creation science is. If you're impressed with the evidence, well, that's good. That's not what we were trying to do. What we're trying to do is show you what it's about and the kind of thing that we consider with creation science. And at this point, I think you know that people who say it's all about religious dogma are lying through their teeth. Why? I think I know why. They don't have any choice. They don't poison the well, tilt the field. They're going to be out the door. That's my prejudiced view. But now you know. Hopefully you were impressed with the evidence. I think there is abundant, undeniable, overwhelming evidence throughout our world. Arrowheads everywhere we look, indication of design. And when you face the Lord in judgment, you're going to have to answer to that. Why didn't you acknowledge your faith in the designer and in his son? We want to extend his invitation this evening to any who have not rendered obedience. Come confessing that faith, repenting of your sins, being baptized into Christ.